If you really want to enjoy eating like one of the family when you travel in Italy, it helps to know the right people.
There are still, and God bless them, little old ladies who grow herbs and who grow a couple of little things in their gardens. It's heaven.
Hi, I'm Rick Steves. Fred Plotkin's back today on Travel with Rick Steves to deepen our appreciation for the pleasures of Italian cuisine. Also, two guides from Slovenia tell us about the little joys of everyday life in their little country.
They say a lot of us are born with skis on our feet. We know how to ski before we know how to walk properly.
And we'll hear why it matters for all of us to visit the important sites of African American history.
It was bone-chilling to actually walk underground through this tunnel that led out to a ravine, which is very much like the experience that slaves went through during that era.
Discover the value of unexpected places in the hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. The value of small or overlooked places can be profound. Coming up in a bit on today's Travel with Rick Steves, we learn about important sites in African American history and what they can teach all of us about our country's shared heritage. And we'll hear what makes Slovenians proud of their small country, where the quality of life is big. And you can join in the conversations at 877-333-RICK. We'll start by exploring the simple pleasure of eating food that doesn't have to be all dressed up and fancy to be good. And as Fred Plotkin knows, the way the kitchens of Italy approach the subject of eating, well, it's worth writing an entire book about. Fred's detailed guide to the local pleasures of the palate in Italy is called Italy for the Gourmet Traveler. Fred, thanks for being back.
Buongiorno, Riccardo.
Come va?
Molto bene, te?
I wish I spoke more Italian and I'd answer you. Hey, Fred, you have, I love the way you call yourself a pleasure activist. What does that mean in the context of travel?
In the context of travel and in life, what it means is to really use our senses. I believe that most people barely acknowledge the gifts, the great gifts that we've been given with our five senses. And by activating them and really focusing on everything that we experience, we take home so much more than just sort of wandering through life. And I believe, too, that when we use our five senses, it builds the sixth one, which is intuition.
It's safe to say one of your favorite countries, and one of my favorite, if not the favorite, is Italy. And maybe there's a connection there, because the Italians are just so unapologetic in their pursuit of pleasure.
Well, pleasure is not a bad thing. I'm always asked to describe it and defend it. And I say there's a difference between pleasure and hedonism. Not that there's anything really wrong with a little hedonism, but I think that mindless pleasure is different from pleasure. Pleasure means piacere. When you meet someone in Italy, you don't say hello, you say piacere. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I think pleasure can be related to ingredients. And when you travel, you find that there are a lot of famous dishes that, at least for me, they don't quite do it outside of the home country. Sauerkraut. I've never really gotten into sauerkraut here in my world, but when I go to Germany, sauerkraut's a whole different thing. I think risotto is similar. You know, you really can find great risotto in its hometown or in its home region.
Well, part of the reason for that is that the Germans with their sauerkraut and the Alsatians in France and the northern Italians with risotto do not take shortcuts. Mm. If we take a shortcut for something, inevitably we reduce the quality. One example that's universal, using a bouillon cube for flavor will never replace the real mushrooms, the real chicken that we would instead prefer to give real flavor to a dish.
So that's why you wrote in your book, if on the menu has a little asterisk and it says, if you order risotto, it'll take 20 extra minutes to make, that's actually a good thing.
That's the thing to get.
That's what you look for, is that asterisk that says, if you order this, it'll take a little longer to make.
Slow food was born in Italy, and I was one of the founders of it. The idea being that good things come to those who wait. If you want fast food, you know what it tastes like. The burger or the fish fillet is always the same. But if you want real ingredients cut at the moment, cooked at the moment, it tastes phenomenally better than any fast food could be.
That's one thing I know that you stress in your book is eating where people appreciate the tempo of good cuisine and the importance of local ingredients. When we enjoy the markets all over Italy, you write that San Remo has one of the best markets in its region or in Italy. Does that really mean anything? Can one town have a better market than the neighboring town?
Absolutely. The reason that among the many that I love San Remo's market is that tourists do not go there. The one in Florence by now basically has been cannibalized by tourism and has lost most of its character, so the Florentines go to other markets that the tourists have not yet found. In San Remo, it's local people, and what they love to do there is identify the provenance of every ingredient, so that we're talking about a small piece of the Ligurian coast, but Taggia may give the olives, Albenga may give the artichokes. Each town gives something, and they label the town it comes from. We're talking about a distance of 30 kilometers, 18 miles. And in addition, there are still, and God bless them, little old ladies who keep patches of land just outside San Remo. They grow their food. They are allowed to come into the market, and they occupy a section, one end of the market. And it's known that these are, in effect, local people, not farmers, who grow herbs and who grow a couple of little things in their gardens. It's heaven.
Mm.
And I prefer those old ladies because it comes from right there.
Now, you just mentioned that tourism has actually gutted the soul of that beautiful Mercato Centrale or whatever in Florence. And I was just there, and I understand what you're saying. There's all sorts of beautiful little salami shops with things on display and so on. But I would imagine salt of the earth people are going elsewhere. One thing you made a big point about in the new edition of your book, Italy for the Gourmet Traveler, is classic towns. And I love this philosophy that I had never thought about before. But if you just have a list of famous towns with famous sites, you're not going to necessarily enjoy the unique distinctions of each region. Whereas if you go to one town that is most typical of that region, then your itinerary as a whole will show you the best variety of, in this case, Italy.
When I talk to Americans, and I'm called 10 times a day and emailed 100 times a day for advice, inevitably they say, we have 10 days to go to Italy, and we plan to go to Rome, Florence, Venice, Tuscany, and could you recommend another town? And my answer is, my recommendation is, in 10 days, at most, you go to two towns.
Mm-hmm.
Pick one of the big three, Rome, Florence, and Venice, and then go someplace off the beaten track. And my idea of the classic town, it doesn't mean it's the best town of a region being like an American state, but it's the town that within its walls gathers so much that is typical of that region. We were talking about San Remo. San Remo has much of what's typical of Liguria, which is the Italian Riviera.
So when we're building an itinerary for Italy, you could choose which regions you want to experience. And then you could choose not necessarily the touristic capital of that town or the political capital of that town. Being a political capital makes it more homogeneous with other areas. Being a touristic town makes it less distinct. But a town that might just be a workaday town that represents that region most vividly.
Absolutely.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Fred Plotkin. And Fred's got a new edition of his book, Italy for the Gourmet Traveler. To me, it's a entree to the culture through the cuisine. And I just love this philosophy of travel. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. We have Clarissa on the phone in Marina Del Rey, California. Clarissa, thanks for your call.
Hi, Rick. Thank you for having me. And I know that Fred's new book, he's writing a new book in the footsteps of Michelangelo. And I would like to know a little more about his new book and also if he knows Michelangelo's favorite dish in Italy.
Thank you for that question. Michelangelo lived almost 89 years, so he must have done something right in terms of his nutrition. I think that he probably would not be called a gastronome. He liked pears a lot, and his standard gift was to send 33 pears to someone, 33 for the 33 years in the life of Christ. He also had a cheese cellar, and in that cellar he kept several types of sheep's milk cheese, one of them called Marzolino from the month of March. It was only made in March, and he particularly loved that cheese. He had a vineyard, and he produced some wine. 1503, I discovered, was a good vintage. He produced some olive oil, and he ate bread. And that really was about it. There was not much more. He lived on pears, cheese, oil, wine, and bread. The book, when I do finish it, because it took him a long time to live his life and it's a long time to write this book, will really cover Michelangelo in terms of Italy. In other words, I'm not an art historian, but I am an Italianist. And how did Michelangelo change Italy, and how did living in Italy change Michelangelo?
That's fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Clarissa. And Fred, in a sentence or two, how did living in Italy change Michelangelo?
The fact that he could not get out of Italy, though he tried, because Italy was in constant ferment and wars, and in his lifetime there were 13 popes. And imagine that every time a pope dies, Michelangelo, in effect, got a new boss. And the boss would say, stop what you're working on now for the old dead pope, and I want you to do things for me. And therefore, it frustrated Michelangelo that a lot of the projects he began, he would have to finish on the sly. He was not like Leonardo, who would abandon things. Michelangelo was a completist, and he stayed up every day, all night, working on the things he began, knowing that history would judge him more than a pope would.
You know, when you talk about Michelangelo's diet, I find when I travel, a lot of restaurants brag about this is a Renaissance recipe or this is a medieval recipe, and I've come to think that's not anything to brag about. I'd rather get a modern recipe. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, the thing about the Renaissance in Italy, I've studied British Renaissance cuisine. It's very interesting. In Italy, it means the infusion of spices and also chocolate, vanilla, things like that, especially in Tuscany, so that you would find, for example, wild boar braised in red wine and chocolate. That's a Renaissance dish. The town of San Gimignano has a restaurant called Dorando that specializes in Renaissance food. I think in most cases, these Renaissance restaurants are not good, but Dorando is an excellent restaurant.
I think I remember reading in your book, Fred, that you thought the three great cuisines of the planet, if you're really going to go to a country for the cuisine, might be China, India, and of all places in Europe, Italy.
Well, Italy is, I think, the great transformer in terms of cuisines. No one else says that. Italy is the place where when an ingredient arrives, such as corn, peppers, tomatoes, chocolate, you name it, the Italians figure out what to do with it to make it taste better than it did in the place it came from. Italians have a phenomenal knowledge of the properties of food and how to best apply it in the kitchen. That makes it different from most other countries.
Fred Plotkin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rick.
Antipasto, mozzarella, vermicelli, fettuccine, rigatoni, ravioli, cannelloni, minestrone, tortellini, cappuccini, calamari, spaghetti.
Fred Plotkin's book includes personally researched recommendations for local eateries all over Italy. It's called Italy for the Gourmet Traveler. Fred also contributes often to the OpraVore blog at New York's WQXR Radio. We have links in this week's program details, which you'll find in the radio section at ricksteves.com. The Simple Pleasures of Slovenia are up next. We're at 877-333-RICK, and by email, it's radio@ricksteves.com. If I asked you to find Slovenia on a map, could you do it? Good things often do come in small packages. To help us better understand how this northern corner of the former Yugoslavia operates and the pleasures that Slovenia offers its citizens and visitors, we turn now to Tina Hiti and Sasho Gulub. They work as tour guides and they're raising their family together in the Lake Bled region of the country. Thanks, Tina, and thanks, Sasho, for joining us.
Thank you.
Dobar dan.
Sasho, if an American is coming to Slovenia for his first time, how do you introduce your country? How is it distinct from the neighboring countries?
As opposed to the U.S., which I've seen a little of, it's small, right? You can go from the ocean to the mountains in about an hour and a half.
So it's about the size of New Jersey.
Yeah, yeah, comparing to
And how many States. People?
2 million.
Wow, 2 million people. So how big is the coastline?
The coastline is 46 kilometers.
So it's about 25 miles
yes.
of a coastline.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to cover one country thoroughly in Europe, this might be a good
if
one.
If you want to cover a coastline thoroughly, go to
now,
Slovenia.
It's an alpine country, and it's a Slavic country. Is that fair to say?
Yes, it is.
So how would the Slavic culture, you're just traveling from Italy or Austria, suddenly you're in a Slavic country. What does that mean for a traveler?
It will change. I wouldn't say dramatically comparing to Italy, but mm-hmm. it will change. There's a little bit looser than, let's say, the Austrians are. And
the Austrians are Germanic and more strict and punctual.
We do have the La Dolce Vita of the Italians. We kind of took the best out of two cultures and yep. made it into what we call our culture, I think.
So from your capital, Ljubljana.
Ljubljana.
You can travel in 2 hours to the west and get to Italy and 2 hours to the north and get to Austria.
Yes, and 2.5 hours northeast and you're in Hungary.
My goodness, so there is a lot of diversity nearby. Tina, when a traveler comes into Slovenia and they want to enjoy the culture and really do something quintessentially Slovenian, what would you invite them to do?
Oh, definitely to go eat because, well, it really gives them a lookout into the country. And what I like about Slovenian cuisine is because we lie on the intersection of different worlds, is that we have the best out of all cultures that are bordering us. And we kind of have this interesting blend of different foods. So we have a little bit of Italian flair with pasta. We have a little bit of Germanic with good meats, sausages. And we also have a very good flair from Hungary getting the best out of their desserts. So I think that's it. And we also have great wines to go along with it.
So this is interesting. I mean, maybe the United States, and we could consider there's a place where four of our states come together. We call it the Four Corners.
Mm-hmm.
And you could do a little hop, skip, and jump and go into all of these different states. But you wouldn't have dramatic changes in culture. In the case of Slovenia, this is sort of the three corners of the three mm-hmm. great cultures in Europe. The Romantic world, that would be the,
yes.
the Mediterranean
yeah.
world, the Germanic world, mm-hmm. and the Slavic world.
Yes.
I would also add another culture here, which is fairly close to us. It's the Ottomans.
The Ottomans.
You have Bosnia, which is not too far. I mean, there's...
So, yeah, and with Yugoslavia, you had that...
There's a little bit of an input from them as well.
So you've even yeah. got that Muslim culture
yeah,
a little bit.
Yeah. It's not dominating, but it's there.
No, but there's a little
yeah.
sprinkling of that.
There's a sprinkle.
For dinner, what would you be sure we should have, Tina?
Oh, for dinner, I would definitely make sure you have some kind of a soup. And we have very hearty soups. A lot of these turnip soups with beans. We have a lot of soups with potatoes and vegetables. And then you would definitely have maybe some kind of a turnip, sausage, potatoes, or maybe our kind of ravioli, which is called žlikrofi.
So how does your ravioli differ from over the border in Italy?
The dough is a little different, and it's made by hand. And then the filling inside is made out of potatoes, parsley, and a little bit of ham and
okay.
other spices.
So that feels like Slavic pasta meets Italian
yes.
pasta then.
Yes, yeah.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're traveling right now in the beautiful little country of Slovenia on the south end of the Alps, the northernmost state of what used to be Yugoslavia. I'm joined by Sasho Golub and Tina Hiti, and our phone number is 877-333-7425. Mendy's on the phone from Edmond, Oklahoma. Mendy, thanks for your call.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
Doing great. Do you have some thoughts on eating in Slovenia?
Yes, I had the chance this summer to stop in Ljubljana for a few hours as I was coming from Croatia to Vienna. And I did not do my research in advance and was totally lost on what to eat. And what should I have tried and what should I try the next time I go back?
So you were in Ljubljana. That's quite an exciting place to drop into if you haven't done your preparation.
No, I was one of those days I wasn't planning to, and my train just happened to stop there for a few hours.
You know, isn't that a great thing about traveling? You can be sitting on the train and be heading for, I don't even be heading for Vienna and say, no, let's take a right turn here at this town. And all of a sudden you've crossed the Alps and you're into a town called Ljubljana. And
yes, it
that's
was great.
The capital of a country you may not have had plans to visit. Did you go to the marketplace in the town?
Yes, I did. And I went up to the fortress castle area and dropped in a few churches as I was walking around. But didn't have a real good plan, but I enjoyed the day there.
Okay, so Tina, if, you know, Mendy drops into the capital of your country, what should she have done from a of a restaurant point of view, what would be a real highlight?
Oh, I would definitely try some of the Slovenian fusion food, which is basically Slovenian old-fashioned cuisine done in a more modern way. And there's a few restaurants in our capital.
And you were talking about the wonderful Hungarian influence for sweets and pastries. What would be a good thing for Mendy?
Talking about the Slovenian cuisine proper is really hard because we've been influenced by so many cultures for so long, but there's a thing called Prekmurska gibanica, which is a dessert that's made in 7 layers. And you're basically looking at a combination of cottage cheese, poppy seeds, walnuts, and apples. And it's all baked in an oven. And if you're wondering, just in case you're wondering, yes, my mouth is watering at the moment.
That sounds great. Tina, how do you pronounce that cake again, Tina?
Oh, Prekmurska gibanica.
And that would be a proper Slovenian cake.
Yes.
I would imagine when I'm in Ljubljana, even if I forget the name, I can see that on the counter and I'll say, I'll have one of those.
Definitely.
Now, I know you come from Bled, another town, and there's a famous pastry in Bled.
Oh, yes. We have cream cakes over there or kremšnita. And kremšnita was actually done because Bled was a former destination for our Marshal Tito. He had his summer residence there and he didn't know what to offer to his guests. And he didn't want to be boring and, you know, just give cookies and maybe a tea or
so
coffee.
So he had something really special for
and
his guests.
And he said, I need to figure out something. So
I didn't realize that. This is Tito's creation.
Yes.
It was created for Tito.
Yes, in 1956 it was created and he put up two chefs together, a chef and a pastry chef, and they made a creation of that. Supposedly the first cream cake was supposed to be covered with chocolate, but chocolate at the time was very expensive and hard to get, so it's covered with sugar. And it's a vanilla custard and cream dessert. And till today, they already done 11 million of those cream cakes.
Does it have some sort of nostalgia for you when you eat this cake to Yugoslavian times?
A little bit, but it just kind of reminds you more of your childhood days because we couldn't get a lot of different desserts.
Couldn't get chocolate back then.
And chocolate wasn't really widely available. So you
were
always excited.
And the chocolate
you
had
excited.
Wasn't very good. It was sort of
not really.
Kind of fake chocolate.
Yeah.
Unless you had friends somewhere outside, the chocolate was really not that good.
But you could have the cream cake.
You could have that, yeah.
Now, do you guys eat a lot of that cream cake?
On occasion, but I was just kind of wanting to refer back, like Tina was saying that, you know, you could get it every now and again. I mean, you would have to behave for 1 year to get it.
It was a very special thing.
It was a special thing, yeah.
All right.
Even just the fact of, I lived in a village which is 4 miles away from Lake Bled. And just going to Bled was kind of a special event. So
as you were a child, you'd go to the big city, which was a small town.
In a way, yes.
Lake Bled. Then if your parents were in a good mood and if you were good kids,
you would get
a cream cake.
Yeah, exactly.
Mendy, you don't need to be a good kid to get a cream cake when you go to Bled, though.
Oh, that sounds good. One of my highlights of the time there in Ljubljana was going up to the fortress and buying the castle up there and buying an ice cream and just sitting there overlooking the city, enjoying a sunny day in June. So I can always have those wonderful memories.
Good for you, Mendy. Thanks for the call.
Thank you, Mendy.
Thank you so much.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're traveling through Slovenia right now with two friends who are Slovenian guides, Tina Hiti and Sasha Golub. Tina, a big thing in Slovenia is beekeeping. And I was really struck by coming into the little villages and there's actually beekeeping museums. How can we enjoy that slice of your culture?
Oh, beekeeping is really a huge thing. If we just calculate the number of inhabitants our country has, probably has the most beekeepers percentage-wise. The village we come from has about maybe 5,000 inhabitants. It has 86 beekeepers. Out of them, they take care of over 2,500 hives, which is a huge number. And how you can enjoy that? Simply, first of all, you can go and visit the Beehive Museum, but we also have a lot of great stuff like painted beehive panels. And this is a true art for Slovenia. So it means that the hives that were usually painted in different colors, here they have scenes from ordinary life. First scenes were usually taken out from the biblical days, but afterwards they also realized they want to make sure they know what's going on. So for example, you have beehives where two farmers are fighting for a cow and the lawyer is milking the cow. Or you have the one that my husband really likes a lot where the devil is sharpening lady's tongue, or how you put an old lady into a mill and a young one comes out.
So there's lots of folk culture.
There's a lot of folk
art.
And those painted beehive panels were also used to study local costumes at the time.
So they're a couple hundred years old and you can see how people would
dress. From the early 1900s.
What do you do with all the honey?
Of course, we eat the honey. There's two brands of honey, but we also use it in our food, so in our pastries. And the one place where we use honey the most is to put it together with schnapps, and we make the honey brandy.
Honey brandy?
Yeah, it's strictly medicinal, though.
Strictly medicinal. Yes. Yes, I can understand. Yes. And all of these little clinics that keep people healthy.
Exactly.
Yes. We're very busy after dinner. When I study Yugoslavia, it occurs to me that Tito was trying to work very hard to bring everything together. And he had this communist idea where you would have all the production of refrigerators in Montenegro and all the production of cars here and all the production of something else there. Did that leave Slovenia with any kind of industry that was originally designed to supply all of Yugoslavia? And today you're lacking many things, but you've got too much of one thing?
It absolutely did, yeah.
What's an example of that?
There was a car-producing plant. There was a fairly, for our standards, a fairly big factory of refrigerators, or basically the kitchen appliances.
So Tito really did try to push this economy of scale. If you have one big factory, it can be done more efficiently.
Yes, but then another thing you need to know, we had almost 70% of the Yugoslavian industry in Slovenia alone.
Is that right?
Yes.
So Slovenia really was the lucky part of Yugoslavia.
Yeah, there must be said.
Because when I go to Slovenia now, and I remember even before the breakup of Yugoslavia, this was the country that felt a lot like Austria. I mean, it was just more Nordic. It was it was more prosperous. Mm-hmm. And it was lucky to get out of the whole Yugoslavia without a lot of bloodshed.
Yeah. We were lucky on that.
It has a lot to do with our history because we were linked to Austrians more than we were to any other nation.
How is the economy going now? Are you happy to be in the EU? Is life better now? Or what is the mindset in Slovenia?
There's pros and there's cons. But realistically, we would not be able to make it on our own.
So it's good
for
a small country. It's good to be tied in with the German-dominated European Union.
Yeah.
Slovenia has a lot of outdoor sports. You're up in the mountains, the Julian Alps. For tourists, what should we know about to enjoy winter and summer when we come and want to get some dose of Slovenian natural wonder?
Well, in the winter time, if you come, you definitely come for skiing, and that's what most Slovenes do. If you don't know how to ski, you're not a proper Slovene anyway.
Really?
Yes. They say a lot of us are born with skis on our feet. We know how to ski before we know how to walk properly.
So there's actually, if somebody wanted to ski in the Alps, you could go to Switzerland or you could go to Slovenia.
Yes.
Why would one choose to go to Slovenia instead of Switzerland?
I think we're kind of a secret on the map that nobody really knows about. And we do have a few nice resorts. I mean, there's a few of those that are just majestically put into the Julian Alps. You have the highest mountain of Slovenia.
And your father was a famous hockey player, a household word in Slovenia.
Yeah.
Tell us about hockey in Slovenia.
Well, hockey is really big sport. We are more into winter sports in Slovenia than we are in the summer sports because, well, especially where we live in the mountains. And hockey, yes, was very popular. When I was growing up, my dad was so popular that he really got fan mails or, you know, letters from the fans. I even needed to forge his signatures for my schoolmates because they wanted my dad's signature.
An autograph.
And I was kind of ashamed, you know. Now I don't want to ask my dad, so I forged his signatures.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're traveling through Slovenia with Tina Hiti and Sasha Golub. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. Edward's calling in from Manassas, Virginia. Edward, thanks for your call.
Oh, hey, Rick. I just want to make the point that I've always tried to go to places that are a little bit off the beaten path for Americans, at least, and I think Slovenia more than fits the bill here. It's a small country that when I got back, people said, where did you go? Where did you go? But then when you get there, it's a very much westernized. Everything is modern. Everything is, you know, very much like anywhere else in Western Europe, but it's obviously it's unique because not that many Americans, I don't think, have been there. It's just so much beautiful things to see there. So many.
You know, it's sort of adorable to have a distinct country that only has 2 million people. I think the president could walk down the street and you could say hello to him in the market.
Very much so. Yeah. I saw him in Ljubljana a couple of weeks ago. He doesn't walk with bodyguards around the town. So,
Edward, did you travel around Slovenia very much?
Yes, we hit the high points, starting with Lake Bled, which I think anybody going there is probably a good first stop because it's just such a beautiful little lake with the church on the island. And then we swung over to the Soča Valley with the scenery and the history in that location, and we did do Ljubljana as well. So I think we hit the highlights, but there's more to see than we were able to do, and I would definitely like to go back and
The world, you know, the World War One history on the Soča front, we always hear about the Western front between France and Germany, but there was a very bloody and hard-fought front in Slovenia. And unlike on the Western front where everything was fought in trenches, this was fought in the ridges high in the mountains. It's just one of the most fascinating sights in all of Europe would be to mix in that World War One history with the dramatic scenery there in the Soča Valley. Thanks for your call, Edward.
Okay.
almost half the tourists seem to go to Bled. It's the resort lake with this beautiful island and the church on the island and the castle on the hill overlooking the island, famous for beautiful traditional boats on the lake. When we go to Bled, is that a good springboard for what would you see from Bled?
Everything in Slovenia is so compact that using Bled as your home base would make you travel to Ljubljana easily.
It's the capital city of Ljubljana.
The capital, it's 45 minutes away
from everywhere. You could see the Lipizzaner horses.
You could see the Lipizzaner horses in an hour's drive, let's say.
The famous caves.
Yes. The caves are 2 hours' drive away from Bled. So I would use Bled as a hub, because even if you don't feel like doing something, you just take a walk around the lake and just enjoy the scenery there.
And then one place I also like to see, where I would actually drive and make a home base, is Piran, the one coastal resort of the country. It's sort of like a little Slovenian, tiny, tiny cousin of Venice or something like that.
Yeah.
Piran. Yeah. What is there, like 10 centimeters of coast for each Slovene or something
about,
like that?
About two centimeters.
2 centimeters per Slovene. So the point is, Slovenia is tight, it's well organized, it's friendly, very diverse, where three great cultures come together.
Yeah.
And as tour guides, if you have an American tourist coming in and you want to give them one classic memory and experience in Slovenia on their visit, Sasha, what would it be for you?
I would take them for a walk around Lake Bled. An hour and a half of fun, nice scenery, quite a bit of history and a few interesting sights along the way as well.
And you could point out Tito's holiday resort.
We could actually go to Tito's villa and have a cup of coffee while we do that.
Tito could go anywhere he wanted to for a vacation, and he chose Lake Bled.
He liked Lake Bled a lot, yeah.
Tina, where would you take an American tourist to give them the classic Slovenian memory?
Oh, I would definitely take them across the Julian Alps and take them to the Mount Mangart, which is above 2,500 meters high. It feels like you're on top of the world because most of the mountains around you are lower than you are. So it's really good. But there's so many places to go to, because we have also medieval towns. We have another beautiful valley called Logarska Valley. And there's also the beautiful Karst area, which is known also as Slovene Tuscany.
So you would take them to a travel agent to arrange for the next trip?
No, but they could do that all by themselves.
That's
so
right.
It's really, there's so many things that you can go for. And no matter that it's so small, it just offers really a lot of variety.
Tina Hiti, Sasha Golub, thank you very much for sharing with us about your country, Slovenia. Hvala.
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 Our next stop on Travel with Rick Steves is closer to home, perhaps even close to where you live. We'll look at the experience you can have when you visit one of the dozens of heritage sites maintained by the National Park Service that reflect African-American history. Many of these historical sites may be small and some may be modest, but the stories they tell give you an appreciation for people whose lives really made a difference. It's Travel with Rick Steves. This year's observance of Black History Month, that's February all across the United States, promises to be a particularly rich experience. 2013 marks important anniversaries in the civil rights movement. The March on Washington was held 50 years ago, and the Emancipation Proclamation was signed 150 years ago. Right now, we'll explore some intriguing historical sites that are scattered all across the country, but particularly in the Southeast. Many of them may seem small or lack grandiosity, but seeing them for yourself can help you understand the contributions made by the people of past generations to the freedoms we value today in America. We're joined right now by Lydia Sermons, the Executive Director of the African American Experience Fund. That's at aaexperience.org. Her organization promotes the importance of visiting and preserving heritage sites operated by the National Park Service. Lydia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me here, Rick.
This is an exciting year.
It is an exciting year for civil rights in our country, dating back to the Civil War era all the way up to the Civil Rights era, which is being commemorated by the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington and Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech in August 2013.
And as the executive director of the African American Experience Fund, Describe, in a nutshell, your mission, what your work is all about.
Our mission is to preserve the rich history of African Americans and to ensure that we connect more young people, youth, and adults with this rich history to hear the full and rich stories of African American history in our nation. All of the sites that we support are actually National Historic Parks that are part of the Park Service. Our relationship with these sites is to raise money for these sites, to create educational programs around these sites, to enhance the stories that are being told through these sites. The African American Experience Fund is a program of the National Park Foundation, which is the official charity and nonprofit partner to our national parks.
How many sites that relate to African American history that are part of our National Historic Sites or National Park System are you working with to help preserve and promote the story of African American history in our country?
We are currently working with 25 African American historic sites, which includes the National Underground Railroad Network to Freedom, which runs across the entire country, as well as the National Gullah Geechee Heritage Territory, which runs throughout the South and expands from North Carolina all the way down to Florida. All of the sites that are listed on our website that we support actually have rangers that are there that you can schedule guided tours with. You can go on the website, you can book your travel in advance, great places to visit during spring break, or whether it's a Saturday. These sites are open on the weekends. These sites are often open on holidays. And many of our sites, in fact, I would venture to say most of our sites are actually fee-free mm-hmm. sites. There's no cost to admission, just the cost of your time.
Lydia, it's a relatively new site, opened, I think, just in the summer of 2011, the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial in Washington, D.C. Describe that site to us, and what are your thoughts about that memorial?
It's a beautiful site that sits on the National Mall just along the banks of the Potomac River, and that site is very significant because it is the first site on the National Mall that is dedicated to an African American. It's a beautiful marble site. It's just breathtaking. And if you ever have a chance to visit that site, I believe one of the best times of day to visit that site is at sunset. Mm. It's just worth seeing. It's worth building into your itinerary. And it commemorates the life of Dr. Martin Luther King and his leadership on civil rights in America, but not just civil rights for African Americans. Dr. King, when he gave that speech back in 1963 on the National Mall, there were also representatives from the Native American community, from Latino communities, from Asian communities. So the civil rights story that is commemorated on the National Mall goes beyond the story of African Americans. We've seen pictures of Dr. King and representatives from other cultures and other races that were actually present there to be a part of this civil rights journey. So it's a site that is representative of all of Americans in our rich history with regards to civil rights.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're speaking with Lydia Sermons, and Lydia is the executive director of the African American Experience Fund. Lydia, let's just say we're planning a family trip.
Sure.
And we want to expose our children to this exciting struggle and have it culminate in Washington, D.C. And of course, you can't do everything because you got to drive from point to point. But you're starting in the southeast of the United States and you're working to Washington, D.C. What are three or four or five stops you'd want to weave together for an itinerary, and why would those be important?
Sure. So let's say you're in Georgia and you're starting in Atlanta. Certainly the Martin Luther King Jr. National Historic Site in Atlanta, Georgia, is a great place to visit, and there's so much history there. Of course, the life of Dr. King and his birthplace and his church and his home, his burial, is commemorated there. And then if you come on up through places like South Carolina and North Carolina, you have the famous F.W. Woolworth Building in Greensboro, North Carolina. There was a sit-in at a lunch counter there to protest African Americans not being able to actually be seated. So that's an amazing site that's being preserved. You can come all the way up through Virginia, and in Richmond, there's an amazing site there. It actually predates the Civil War era, but there's a home there called the Maggie Lena Walker Home. And Maggie Lena Walker is an African American woman who was the first woman to charter a bank in the United States.
First woman?
African-American woman.
What year was that?
1904.
Okay.
And against all odds, she started a bank that gave rise to an amazing community in Richmond, Virginia. So people are very familiar with Harlem, for instance, and the wealth of Harlem. Well, there was a Harlem in the South, and it was called the Jackson Ward Community in Richmond, Virginia. So before there was Harlem, there was Jackson Ward, and the home still exists. It's an amazing site that is beautifully preserved. If you walk through it, you will see her in her everyday life, pictures with Frederick Douglass and gentlemen during that era who made history. It's just a fabulous wow. site. And then, of course, if you come on up to Washington, D.C., we have five sites in the D.C. metropolitan area that commemorate African-American history and the struggle for civil rights. One of them, of course, being the Frederick Douglass home, which is an amazing site here. It sits on the highest point of Washington, D.C., and you can actually go up to Frederick Douglass's home and look down on the nation's capital. It's an amazing, breathtaking place to visit and walk through his house and where he lived and see his library, see the clothes that he wore, and you can see the desk that he sat at. You can see some of his writings. It's just an amazing location for you to see this great orator in the place that inspired him to serve as an advocate and an abolitionist. It's the place that gave birth to his newspaper, the North Star. We also have the Mary McLeod Bethune House here. Mary McLeod Bethune was the first African-American to serve as a presidential advisor.
She advised Roosevelt, right?
That's correct, and had a very, very, very close relationship with Eleanor Roosevelt.
Hmm.
And she also convened many of the nation's up-and-coming civil rights leaders in her home who began to petition the White House for changes in civil rights policies. So she was a very influential policy advisor as well as an educator. We also have the Carter G. Woodson home here in Washington, D.C., which is under major renovation, but that's also a very significant site here, and it's a story worth looking into to learn more about Carter G. Woodson. Carter G. Woodson was the founder of Black History Month.
Lydia, when you think about all of these very important historic sites, would you say that they did not get the respect they deserved until after the great accomplishments of the civil rights movement in the last generation, and you've got some catching up to do, and is that part of the mission of your organization?
We recognize that the stories of African Americans and our rich contributions to American history have never been fully and accurately told. So it is our singular goal to ensure that the rich contributions of African Americans to American history are fully and more accurately told, and not just to African American populations, to all populations throughout the nation, because it's so important that we understand what has brought us together as a nation. We built this country together. We are all a part of these United States of America, and we have facets of our history that people just don't know and they don't know about. So our goal is to make sure we are bringing this rich history to the forefront as people visit these national park sites.
Of course, you're the executive director of the African American Experience Fund, but you're also the mother of three. Tell us about your parenting experience, taking your kids to some of these sites, and what was that like as a mother, and what kind of impact did that have on your children?
Well, if you could see me now, you could see a big grin on my face as you talk about that, because one of the things that I am determined to do is to ensure that my children know about this rich and diverse history that it took me years to come into the knowledge of. It wasn't really until I took on this position that I really began to look more and more about the contributions that African Americans have made to American history and to dig into these stories. So I went on a Southern driving tour last summer with my three children. I have a set of twins who are in elementary school and kindergarten now, and I have a seven-year-old. And I took them with me. We had visited Hilton Head, for instance, on many occasions. We visited Hilton Head to experience the beach there. But it wasn't until I came into this job that I learned about a community and the rich African-American history at Hilton Head Island in South Carolina. And there is a community there called the Mitchellville community. Mitchellville was the first free African-American community during the Civil War. During the Civil War, the slaves that were there on Hilton Head Island were moved over into this area of the island and actually then brought down African-American soldiers to protect this new community. And it was an amazing, wealthy community right there in Hilton Head Island. In fact, some of those families are still there and are landowners on Hilton Head Island. And there's a restoration project underway to restore the Mitchellville community, to build a museum there, to replicate part of this community. And so I took my children with me to experience and to walk the grounds of this community that was right there on the banks of the Savannah Wow. River. So the first African-American free community that was protected by African-Americans who built an earthen wooden fort called Fort Howell that was built by African-American soldiers. And you can see where the moat was. There's a little bridge that is still there to show you where the moat was to cross over onto Fort Howell. And when my two sons crossed over on the moat, they said, wow, mommy, this is really cool.
Oh, man.
So through these experiences, I am taking my children across country so that they can learn about this rich history, because they're asking me questions about why were African Americans enslaved? Why did that have to happen? And what did it take for, you know, President Lincoln to actually free the slaves? So they're asking me questions that are forcing me to also learn this history so that I can teach them in a way that my generation was not taught.
From a parent's point of view, what would the top three or four experiences to gain an empathy for the struggles and an appreciation of how far we've come and how horrible it was?
I would say if you have the opportunity to experience an Underground Railroad Network to Freedom site, that is a great start, whether it's in Boston or Nebraska City or another location, because, again, you get the experience of walking back into time and experiencing what real life was like for individuals of that time versus visiting a monument that commemorates what happened. The Tuskegee Airmen Institute in Alabama is another great site which tells the story of African Americans who, you know, were pilots and against all odds succeeded in helping this nation win a war.
And the spirit, the patriotic spirit of, even though these African American airmen were segregated, they gave it all to this society. And it's hard to imagine as recent as our lifetimes, we have these courageous patriots who were still segregated.
That's correct. And there are places in Louisiana like the Cane River Creole Plantation where you can actually still see physical structures, multiple structures that still exist that you can walk through, and you can see the artifacts that have been preserved from that day and age. So those are some amazing sites.
Lydia Sermons of the African American Experience Fund is cluing us in on the value of experiencing the history and people who helped shape America and the freedoms we enjoy today. A list of sites and the stories they contribute is at aaexperience.org. And the National Park Service provides heritage itineraries on its website. That's at nps.gov. Most of us know about the Underground Railroad back in slavery times. Let's think in terms of an itinerary. Tell us about the Underground Railroad Network to Freedom and how we would see that today.
The Underground Railroad Network to Freedom is an amazing trail that runs throughout this entire country from north to south, east and west, that guided many people to final destinations, whether they were headed north to Canada or whether they were headed to South America on their quest to drive towards freedom. And so I had the pleasure of visiting a site out in Omaha, Nebraska. And what was so amazing, it's called the Mayhew Cabin in Nebraska City. And it's a two-story log cabin site that was an abolitionist family site that has still been preserved right there in Nebraska City by the city. And what's amazing is you can actually go underneath this log cabin home and have the actual underground tunnel experience. They've got the little ante rooms underground that shows where slaves were actually hidden when the soldiers would come looking for them. And you walk through this tunnel and it lets out to a ravine. So you get that real life experience. So I encourage families to go online, look up these places and go visit them.
Now that sounds really incredible. That sounds like the best single opportunity for an American family to get a sense of what that must have been like to be escaping on the Underground Railroad to freedom.
It was bone chilling to actually walk underground through this tunnel that led out to a ravine, which is very much like the experience that slaves went through during that era. But I will tell you, most of these historic sites, the African heritage sites, are still well preserved to this day. So when you walk into these places, it's like you're walking back in time.
What an exciting job you have. Lydia Sermons, the executive director of the African American Experience Fund, preserving and promoting national park sites that tell the stories of African Americans. Lydia, what's the most gratifying thing about your work?
The most gratifying thing about my work is watching the faces, listening to the questions, hearing the responses from young people like my three children when they learn about someone like Dr. Martin Luther King and Frederick Douglass. And when I explain to them that we can live in the community that we live in today, we can have the jobs we have, we can attend the schools that we attend because of the work of these people and because of their hard-fought battles. So the most gratifying part of my job is seeing this awakening in the minds of young people when they connect with this rich history.
Lydia Sermons, thank you so much and best wishes with your work.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
The riverbank makes a very good road. The dead trees will show you the way. Left foot, peg foot, traveling on. Follow the drink and go. The river ends between two hills. Follow the drink and go. There's another river on the other side. Follow the drink and go. When the great big river meets the little river, follow the drink and go. For the old man is waiting for to carry you to freedom. Follow the drink and go.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Europe Through the Back Door in Edmonds, Washington, by Tim Tatton with Sarah McCormick. Thanks to the Radio Foundation in New York City and National Public Radio in Washington for their help today. You can chat with Rick and his guests. Simply add your email address to the Sign Me Up link, and that's in the radio section of our website. That way we can notify you of our next recording sessions and topics. That's all at ricksteves.com. And we'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Rick Steves teaches smart European travel. At ricksteves.com, you'll find an archive of interviews from his radio show, free audio tours of Europe's top sites, a monthly travel newsletter, and a world of information to help you turn your European travel dreams into smooth and affordable reality. To gear up for your next European adventure, begin your trip at ricksteves.com.